The Village of Stepanchikovo, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 1, Chapter 1, Introduction. When my uncle, Colonel Yegor Ilyich Rostanev, left the army, he settled down in Stepanchikovo, which came to him by inheritance, and went on steadily living in it, as though he had been all his life a regular country gentleman who had never left his estates. There are natures that are perfectly satisfied with everyone and can get used to everything. Such was precisely the disposition of the retired colonel. It is hard to imagine a man more peaceable and ready to agree to anything. If by some caprice he had been gravely asked to carry someone for a couple of miles on his shoulders, he would perhaps have done so. He was so good-natured that he was sometimes ready to give away everything at the first asking, and to share almost his last shirt with anyone who coveted it. He was of heroic proportions, tall and well-made, with ruddy cheeks, with teeth white as ivory, with a long brown moustache, with a loud ringing voice, and with a frank, hearty laugh. He spoke rapidly and jerkily. He was at the time of my story about 40, and had spent his life, almost from his 16th year, in the Hussars. He had married very young, and was passionately fond of his wife, but she died, leaving in his heart a noble memory that nothing could efface. When he inherited Stepanchikovo, which increased his fortune to 600 serfs, he left the army, and, as I have said already, settled in the country, together with his children, Ilyusha, a boy of 8, whose birth had cost his mother's life, and Sashenka, a girl of 15, who had been brought up at a boarding school in Moscow. But my uncle's house soon became a regular Noah's Ark. This was how it happened. Just at the time when he came into the property and retired from the army, his mother, who had 16 years before married a certain General Krahotkin, was left a widow. At the time of her second marriage, my uncle was only a cornet, and yet he, too, was thinking of getting married. His mother had, for a long time, refused her blessing, had shed bitter tears, had reproached him with egoism, with ingratitude, with disrespect. She had proved to him that his estates, amounting to only 250 serfs, were, as it was, barely sufficient for the maintenance of his family, that is, for the maintenance of his mamma, with all her retinue of toadies, pug-dogs, Pomeranians, Chinese cats, and so on. And in the midst of these reproaches, protests, and shrill upbraidings, she all at once, quite unexpectedly, got married herself, before her son, though she was 42 years of age. Even in this, however, she found an excuse for blaming my poor uncle, declaring that she was getting married solely to secure, in her old age, the refuge denied her by the undutiful egoist her son, who was contemplating the unpardonable insolence of making a home of his own. I never could find out what really induced a man apparently so reasonable as the deceased General Krahotkin to marry a widow of 42. It must be supposed that he suspected she had money. Other people thought that he only wanted a nurse, as he had already had a foretaste of the swarm of diseases which assailed him in his old age. One thing is certain. The general never had the faintest respect for his wife at any time during his married life, and he ridiculed her sarcastically at every favourable opportunity. He was a strange person, half-educated and extremely shrewd. He had a lively contempt for all and everyone. He had no principles of any sort, laughed at everything and everybody, and in his old age, through the infirmities that were the consequence of his irregular and immoral life, he became spiteful, irritable, and merciless. He had been a successful officer, yet he had been forced, through an unpleasant incident, to resign his commission, losing his pension and only just escaping prosecution. This had completely soured his temper. Left almost without means, with no fortune but 100 ruined serfs, he folded his hands and never, during the remaining 12 years of his life, troubled himself to inquire what he was living on and who was supporting him. At the same time, he insisted on having all the comforts of life, kept his carriage, and refused to curtail his expenses. Soon after his marriage, he lost the use of his legs, and spent the last 10 years of his life in an invalid chair, wheeled about by 2 7-foot flunkies, who never heard anything from him but abuse of the most varied kind. The carriage, the flunkies, and the invalid chair were paid for by the undutiful son, who sent his mother his last farthing, mortgaged and remortgaged his estate, denied himself necessaries, and incurred debts almost impossible for him to pay in his circumstances at the time. And yet the charge of being an egoist and an undutiful son was persistently laid at his door. But my uncle's character was such that, at last, he quite believed himself that he was an egoist, and therefore, to punish himself and to avoid being an egoist, he kept sending them more and more money. His mother stood in awe of her husband, but what pleased her most was that he was a general, and that, through him, she was Madame la Générale. She had her own apartments in the house, where, during the whole period of her husband's semi-existence, she queened it in a society made up of toadies, lapdogs, and the gossips of the town. She was an important person in her little town. Gossip, invitations to stand godmother at christenings and to give the bride away at weddings, a halfpenny rubber, and the respect shown her in all sorts of ways as the wife of a general fully made up to her for the drawbacks of her home life. All the magpies of the town came to her with their reports. The first place everywhere was always hers. In fact, she got out of her position all she could get out of it. The general did not meddle in all that, but before people he laughed mercilessly at his wife, asked himself, for instance, such questions as why he had married such a dowdy, and nobody dared contradict him. Little by little, all his acquaintances left him, and at the same time, society was essential to him. He loved chatting, arguing. He liked to have a listener always sitting beside him. He was a free thinker and atheist of the old school, and so liked to hold forth on lofty subjects. But the listeners of the town of N had no partiality for lofty subjects, and they became fewer and fewer. They tried to get up a game of whist in the household, but as a rule the game ended in outbreaks on the part of the general, which so terrified his wife and her companions that they put up candles before the icons, had a service sung, divined the future with beans and with cards, distributed rolls among the prisoners, and looked forward in a tremor to the after-dinner hour, when they would have to take a hand at whist again, and at every mistake to endure shouts, screams, oaths, and almost blows. The general did not stand on ceremony with anybody when something was not to his taste. He screamed like a peasant woman, swore like a coachman, sometimes tore up the cards, threw them about the floor, drove away his partners, and even shed tears of anger and vexation, and for no more than a knave's having been played instead of a nine. At last, as his eyesight was failing, they had to get him a reader. It was then that Fomor Fomitch Opiskin appeared on the scene. I must confess, I announce this new personage with a certain solemnity. There is no denying that he is one of the principal characters in my story. How far he has a claim on the attention of the reader, I will not explain. The reader can answer that question more suitably and more readily himself. Foma Fomitch entered General Krahotkin's household as a paid companion, neither more nor less. Where he turned up from is shrouded in the mists of obscurity. I have, however, made special researches, and have found out something of the past circumstances of this remarkable man. He was said, in the first place, to have been some time and somewhere in the government service, and somewhere or other to have suffered, I need hardly say, for a good cause. It was said, too, that at some time he had been engaged in literary pursuits in Moscow. There is nothing surprising in that. Foma Fomitch's crass ignorance would, of course, be no hindrance to him in a literary career. But all that is known for certain is that he did not succeed in anything, and that at last he was forced to enter the general service in the capacity of reader and martyr. There was no ignominy which he had not to endure in return for eating the general's bread. It is true that in later years, when on the general's death he found himself a person of importance and consequence, he more than once assured us all that his consenting to be treated as a buffoon was an act of magnanimous self-sacrifice on the altar of friendship, that the general had been his benefactor, that the deceased had been a great man misunderstood, who only to him, Foma, had confided the inmost secrets of his soul. That, in fact, if he, Foma, had actually, at the general's urgent desire, played the part of various wild beasts and posed in grotesque attitudes, this had been solely in order to entertain and distract a suffering friend shattered by disease. But Foma Fomitch's assurances and explanations on this score can only be accepted with considerable hesitation. And yet this same Foma Fomitch, even at the time when he was a buffoon, was playing a very different part in the ladies' apartments of the general's house. How he managed this, it is difficult for anyone not a specialist in such matters to conceive. The general's lady cherished a sort of mysterious reverence for him. Why? There is no telling. By degrees, he acquired over the whole feminine half of the general's household a marvellous influence, to some extent comparable to the influence exercised by the Ivan Yakovlevitches and such like seers and prophets who are visited in madhouses by certain ladies who devote themselves to the study of their ravings. He read aloud to them works of spiritual edification, held forth with eloquent tears on the Christian virtues, told stories of his life and his heroic doings, went to Mass and even to matins, at times foretold the future, had a peculiar faculty for interpreting dreams, and was a great hand at throwing blame on his neighbours. The general had a notion of what was going on in the back rooms, and tyrannised over his dependent more mercilessly than ever. But Foma's martyrdom only increased his prestige in the eyes of Madame la Générale and the other females of the household. At last, everything was transformed. The general died. His death was rather original. The former free thinker and atheist became terror-stricken beyond all belief. He shed tears, repented, had icons put up, sent for priests. Services were sung, and extreme unction was administered. The poor fellow screamed that he did not want to die, and even asked Foma Fomitch's forgiveness with tears. This latter circumstance was an asset of some value to Foma Fomitch later on. Just before the parting of the general's soul from the general's body, however, the following incident took place. The daughter of Madame la Générale by her first marriage, my maiden aunt, Praskovya Ilyinichna, who always lived in the general's house and was one of his favourite victims, quite indispensable to him during the 10 years that he was bedridden, always at his beck and call, and with her meek and simple-hearted mildness the one person who could satisfy him, went up to his bedside shedding bitter tears, and would have smoothed the pillow under the head of the sufferer. But the sufferer still had strength to clutch at her hair and pull it violently 3 times, almost foaming at the mouth with spite. 10 minutes later, he died. They had sent word to the colonel, though Madame la Générale had declared that she did not want to see him, and would sooner die than set eyes on him at such a moment. There was a magnificent funeral, at the expense, of course, of the undutiful son, on whom the widowed mother did not wish to set her eyes. In the ruined property of Kniazevka, which belonged to several different owners, and in which the general had his 100 serfs, there stands a mausoleum of white marble, diversified with laudatory inscriptions to the glory of the intellect, talents, nobility of soul, orders of merit, and rank of the deceased. Foma Fomitch took a prominent part in the composition of these eulogies. Madame la Générale persisted for a long time in keeping up her dignity and refusing to forgive her disobedient son. Sobbing and making a great outcry, surrounded by her crowd of toadies and pug-dogs, she kept declaring that she would sooner live on dry bread, and I need hardly say, soak it in her tears, that she would sooner go stick in hand to beg alms under the windows than yield to the request of her disobedient son that she should come and live with him at Stepanchikovo, and that she would never, never set foot within his house. As a rule, the word foot in this connection is uttered with peculiar effect by ladies. Madame la Générale's utterance of the word was masterly, artistic. In short, the amount of eloquence that was expended was incredible. It must be observed that at the very time of these shrill protests, they were, by degrees, packing up to move to Stepanchikovo. The colonel knocked up all his horses, driving almost every day 30 miles from Stepanchikovo to the town, and it was not till a fortnight after the general's funeral that he received permission to appear before the eyes of his aggrieved parent. Foma Fomitch was employed as a go-between. During the whole of that fortnight, he was reproaching the disobedient son and putting him to shame for his inhuman conduct, reducing him to genuine tears, almost to despair. It is from this time that the incomprehensible, inhumanly despotic domination of Foma Fomitch over my poor uncle dates. Foma perceived the kind of man he had to deal with, and felt at once that his days of playing the buffoon were over, and that in the wilds even Foma might pass for a nobleman. And he certainly made up for lost time.
"What will you feel like," said Foma, "if your own mother, the authoress, so to speak, of your days, should take a stick, and leaning on it with trembling hands, wasted with hunger, should actually begin to beg for alms under people's windows? Would it not be monstrous, considering her rank as a general's lady and the virtues of her character? What would you feel like if she should suddenly come, by mistake, of course, but you know it might happen, and should stretch out her hand under your windows while you, her own son, are perhaps at that very moment nestling in a feather bed and, in fact, in luxury? It's awful, awful. But what is most awful of all, allow me to speak candidly, Colonel, what is most awful of all is the fact that you are standing before me now like an unfeeling post, with your mouth open and your eyes blinking, so that it is a positive disgrace, while you ought to be ready at the mere thought of such a thing, to tear your hair out by the roots, and to shed streams, oh, what am I saying, rivers, lakes, seas, oceans of tears.
In short, Foma, in his excessive warmth, grew almost incoherent. But such was the invariable outcome of his eloquence. It ended, of course, in Madame la Générale, together with her female dependents and lapdogs, with Foma Fomitch and with Mademoiselle Perepelitsin, her chief favourite, at last honouring Stepanchikovo by her presence. She said that she would merely make the experiment of living at her son's till she had tested his dutifulness. You can imagine the colonel's position while his dutifulness was being tested. At first, as a widow recently bereaved, Madame la Générale thought it her duty 2 or 3 times a week to be overcome by despair at the thought of her general never to return. And punctually on each occasion, the colonel, for some unknown reason, came in for a wigging. Sometimes, especially if visitors were present, Madame la Générale would send for her grandchildren, little Ilyusha and 15-year-old Sashenka, and, making them sit down beside her, would fix upon them a prolonged, melancholy, anguished gaze, as upon children ruined in the hands of such a father. She would heave deep, painful sighs, and finally melt into mute, mysterious tears for at least a full hour. Woe betide the colonel if he failed to grasp the significance of those tears. And, poor fellow, he hardly ever succeeded in grasping their significance, and in the simplicity of his heart almost always put in an appearance at such tearful moments, and, whether he liked it or not, came in for a severe heckling. But his filial respect in no way decreased, and reached at last an extreme limit. In short, both Madame la Générale and Foma Fomitch were fully conscious that the storm which had for so many years menaced them in the presence of General Krahotkin had passed away and would never return. Madame la Générale used at times to fall on her sofa in a swoon. A great fuss and commotion arose. The colonel was crushed and trembled like a leaf.
"Cruel son!" Madame la Générale would shriek as she came to. "You have lacerated my inmost being, mes entrailles, oh, mes entrailles!" "But how have I lacerated your inmost being, mamma?" the colonel would protest timidly. "You have lacerated it! Oh, he justifies himself, too. He is rude. Oh, cruel son, I am dying."
The colonel was, of course, annihilated. But it somehow happened that Madame la Générale always revived again. Half an hour later, he would be taking someone by the buttonhole and saying,
"Oh, well, my dear fellow, you see she is a grande dame, the wife of a general. She is the kindest-hearted old lady. She is accustomed to all this refined... Oh, she's on a different level from a blockhead like me. Now, she is angry with me, no doubt. I am to blame. Oh, my dear fellow, I don't know yet what I've done, but no doubt it's my fault."
It would happen that Mademoiselle Perepelitsin, an old maid in a shawl with no eyebrows, with little rapacious eyes, with lips thin as a thread, with hands washed in cucumber water, and with a spite against the whole universe, would feel it her duty to read the colonel a lecture.
"It's all through your being undutiful, sir. It's all through your being an egoist, sir. Through your wounding your mamma, sir. She's not used to such treatment. She's a general's lady, and you are only a colonel, sir."
"'That is Mademoiselle Perepilitsin, my dear fellow,' the colonel would observe to his listener. "'An excellent lady. She stands up for my mother like a rock, a very rare person. "'You mustn't imagine that she is in a menial position. "'She is the daughter of a major herself. Yes, indeed.'
But, of course, this was only the prelude. The great lady who could carry out such a variety of performances, in her turn trembled like a mouse in the presence of her former dependent. Foma Fomitch had completely bewitched her. She could not make enough of him, and she saw with his eyes and heard with his ears. A cousin of mine, also a retired hussar, a man still young, though he had been an incredible spendthrift, told me bluntly and simply that it was his firm conviction, after staying for a time at my uncle's, that Madame la Générale was on terms of improper intimacy with Foma Fomitch. I need hardly say that at the time I rejected this supposition with indignation, as too coarse and simple. No, it was something different, and that something different I cannot explain without first explaining to the reader the character of Foma Fomitch, as I understood it later. Imagine the most insignificant, the most cowardly creature, an outcast from society, of no service to anyone, utterly useless, utterly disgusting, but incredibly vain, though entirely destitute of any talent by which he might have justified his morbidly sensitive vanity. I hasten to add that Foma Fomitch was the incarnation of unbounded vanity, but that at the same time it was a special kind of vanity. That is, the vanity found in a complete non-entity, and, as is usual in such cases, a vanity mortified and oppressed by grievous failures in the past. A vanity that has begun rankling long, long ago, and ever since has given off envy and venom at every encounter, at every success of anyone else. I need hardly say that all this was seasoned with the most unseemly touchiness, the most insane suspiciousness. It may be asked, how is one to account for such vanity? How does it arise, in spite of complete insignificance, in pitiful creatures who are forced by their social position to know their place? How answer such a question? Who knows? Perhaps there are exceptions, of whom my hero is one. He certainly is an exception to the rule, as will be explained later. But allow me to ask, are you certain that those who are completely resigned to be your buffoons, your parasites and your toadies, and consider it an honour and a happiness to be so, are you certain that they are quite devoid of vanity and envy? What of the slander and backbiting, and tale-bearing, and mysterious whisperings in back corners, somewhere aside and at your table? Who knows, perhaps, in some of these degraded victims of fate, your fools and buffoons, vanity, far from being dispelled by humiliation, is even aggravated by that very humiliation, by being a fool and buffoon, by eating the bread of dependence and being for ever forced to submission and self-suppression. Who knows? Maybe this ugly, exaggerated vanity is only a false, fundamentally depraved sense of personal dignity, first outraged perhaps in childhood by oppression, poverty, filth, spat upon perhaps in the person of the future outcast's parents before his eyes. But I have said that Foma Fomitch was also an exception to the general rule. That is true. He had at one time been a literary man, slighted and unrecognised, and literature is capable of ruining men very different from Foma Fomitch. I mean, of course, when it is not crowned with success. I don't know, but it may be assumed that Foma Fomitch had been unsuccessful before entering on a literary career, possibly in some other calling too, he had received more kicks than halfpence, or possibly something worse. About that, however, I cannot say. But I made inquiries later on, and I know for certain that Foma Fomitch composed, at some time in Moscow, a romance very much like those that were published every year by dozens in the 30s, after the style of The Deliverance of Moscow, The Chieftains of the Tempest, Sons of Love, or the Russians in novels which in their day afforded an agreeable butt for the wit of Baron Brambeus. That was, of course, long ago. But the serpent of literary vanity sometimes leaves a deep and incurable sting, especially in insignificant and dull-witted persons. Foma Fomitch had been disappointed from his first step in a literary career, and it was then that he was finally enrolled in the vast army of the disappointed, from which all the crazy saints, hermits, and wandering pilgrims come later on. I think that his monstrous boastfulness, his thirst for praise and distinction, for admiration and homage, dates from the same period. Even when he was a buffoon, he got together a group of idiots to do homage to him. Somewhere, and somehow, to stand first, to be an oracle, to swagger and give himself airs, that was his most urgent craving. As others did not praise him, he began to praise himself. I have myself in my uncle's house at Stepanchikovo heard Foma's sayings after he had become the absolute monarch and oracle of the household.
"I am not in my proper place among you," he would say sometimes with mysterious impressiveness. "I am not in my proper place here. I will look round, I will settle you all, I will show you, I will direct you, and then good-bye. To Moscow to edit a review. 30,000 people will assemble every month to hear my lectures. My name will be famous at last, and then, woe to my enemies."
But while waiting to become famous, the genius insisted upon immediate recognition in substantial form. It is always pleasant to receive payment in advance, and in this case it was particularly so. I know that he seriously assured my uncle that some great work lay before him, Foma, in the future, a work for which he had been summoned into the world, and to the accomplishment of this work he was urged by some sort of person with wings, who visited him at night, or something of that kind. This great work was to write a book full of profound wisdom in the soul-saving line, which would set the whole world agog and stagger all Russia. And when all Russia was staggered, he, Foma, disdaining glory, would retire into a monastery, and in the catacombs of Kiev would pray day and night for the happiness of the fatherland. All this imposed upon my uncle. Well, now imagine what this Foma, who had been all his life oppressed and crushed, perhaps actually beaten too, who was vain and secretly lascivious, who had been disappointed in his literary ambitions, who had played the buffoon for a crust of bread, who was at heart a despot in spite of all his previous abjectness and impotence, who was a braggart and insolent when successful, might become, when he suddenly found himself in the haven he had reached after so many ups and downs, honoured and glorified, humoured and flattered, thanks to a patroness who was an idiot, and a patron who was imposed upon and ready to agree to anything. I must, of course, explain my uncle's character more fully, or Foma Fomitch's success cannot be understood. But for the moment I will say that Foma was a complete illustration of the saying, "Let him sit down to the table, and he will put his feet on it." He paid us out for his past, A base soul, escaping from oppression, becomes an oppressor. Foma had been oppressed, and he had at once a craving to oppress others. He had been the victim of whims and caprices, and now he imposed his own whims and caprices on others. He had been the butt of others, and now he surrounded himself with creatures whom he could turn into derision. His boasting was ridiculous. The airs he gave himself were incredible. Nothing was good enough for him. His tyranny was beyond all bounds, and it reached such a pitch that simple-hearted people who had not witnessed his manoeuvres, but only heard queer stories about him, looked upon all this as a miracle, as the work of the devil, crossed themselves and spat. I was speaking of my uncle. Without explaining his remarkable character, I repeat, it is of course impossible to understand Foma Fomitch's insolent domination in another man's house. It is impossible to understand the metamorphosis of the cringing dependent into the great man. Besides being kind-hearted in the extreme, my uncle was a man of the most refined delicacy, in spite of a somewhat rough exterior, of the greatest generosity, and of proved courage. I boldly say of courage. Nothing could have prevented him from fulfilling an obligation, from doing his duty. In such cases, no obstacle would have dismayed him. His soul was as pure as a child's. He was a perfect child at 40, open-hearted in the extreme, always good-humoured, imagining everybody an angel, blaming himself for other people's shortcomings, and exaggerating the good qualities of others, even presupposing them where they could not possibly exist. He was one of those very generous and pure-hearted men who are positively ashamed to assume any harm of another, are always in haste to endow their neighbours with every virtue, rejoice at other people's success, and in that way always live in an ideal world, and when anything goes wrong, always blame themselves first. To sacrifice themselves in the interest of others is their natural vocation. Some people would have called him cowardly, weak-willed and feeble. Of course, he was weak, and indeed he was of too soft a disposition, but it was not from lack of will, but from the fear of wounding, of behaving cruelly, from excess of respect for others and for mankind in general. He was, however, weak-willed and cowardly only when nothing was at stake but his own interests, which he completely disregarded, and for this he was continually an object of derision, and often with the very people for whom he was sacrificing his own advantage. He never believed, however, that he had enemies. He had them, indeed, but he somehow failed to observe them. He dreaded fuss and disturbance in the house like fire, and immediately gave way to anyone and submitted to anything. He gave in through a sort of shy good nature, from a sort of shy delicacy.
"So be it," he would say,
quickly brushing aside all reproaches for his indulgence and weakness.
"So be it, that everyone might be happy and contented."
I need hardly say that he was ready to submit to every honourable influence. What is more, an adroit rogue might have gained complete control over him, and even have lured him on to do wrong, of course misrepresenting the wrong action as a right one. My uncle very readily put faith in other people, and was often far from right in doing so. When, after many sufferings, he brought himself at last to believe that the man who deceived him was dishonest, he always blamed himself first, and sometimes blamed himself only. Now imagine, suddenly queening it in his quiet home, a capricious, doting, idiot woman, inseparable from another idiot, her idol, a woman who had only feared her general and was now afraid of nothing, and was impelled by a craving to make up to herself for what she had suffered in the past. And this idiot woman my uncle thought it his duty to revere, simply because she was his mother. They began with proving to my uncle at once that he was coarse, impatient, ignorant, and selfish to the utmost degree. The remarkable thing is that the idiotic old lady herself believed in what she professed, and I believe that Foma Fomitch did also, at least to some extent. They persuaded my uncle, too, that Foma had been sent from heaven by divine providence for the salvation of his soul and the subduing of his unbridled passions, that he was haughty, proud of his wealth, and quite capable of reproaching Foma Fomitch for eating his bread. My poor uncle was very soon convinced of the depth of his degradation, was ready to tear his hair and to beg forgiveness. "It's all my own fault, brother," he would say sometimes to one of the people he used to talk to. "It's all my fault. One ought to be doubly delicate with a man who is under obligations to one—I mean that, under obligations indeed. No, oh, I am talking nonsense again. He is not under obligations to me at all. On the contrary, it is I who am under an obligation to him for living with me. Oh, and here I have reproached him for eating my bread. Oh, not that I did reproach him, but it seems I made some slip of the tongue. I often do make such slips. And after all, the man has suffered. He has done great things. For 10 years, in spite of insulting treatment, he was tending his sick friend. And then his learning. Oh, he's a writer, a highly educated man, a very lofty character, in short." The conception of the highly educated and unfortunate Foma, ignominiously treated by the cruel and capricious general, rent my uncle's heart with compassion and indignation. All Foma's peculiarities, all his ignoble doings, my uncle at once ascribed to his sufferings, the humiliations he had endured in the past, and the bitterness left by them. He at once decided, in his soft and generous heart, that one could not be so exacting with a man who had suffered as with an ordinary person, that one must not only forgive him, but more than that, one must, by gentle treatment, heal his wounds, restore him, and reconcile him with humanity. Setting this object before him, he was completely fired by it, and lost all power of perceiving that his new friend was a lascivious and capricious animal, an egoist, a sluggard, a lazy drone, and nothing more. He put implicit faith in Foma's genius and learning. I forgot to mention that my uncle had the most naive and disinterested reverence for the words learning and literature, though he had himself never studied anything. This was one of his chief and most guileless peculiarities.
"He is writing," he would whisper, walking on tiptoe, though he was 2 rooms away from Foma's study. "I don't know precisely what he is writing," he added, with a proud and mysterious air, "but no doubt he is brewing something, brother. I mean, in the best sense, of course. It would be clear to some people, but to you and me, brother, it would be just a jumble that... I fancy he is writing of productive forces of some sort. He said so himself. I suppose that has something to do with politics. Oh, yes, his name will be famous. Then we shall be famous through him. He told me that himself, brother."
I know for a fact that my uncle was forced by Foma's orders to shave off his beautiful, fair whiskers. Foma considered that these whiskers made my uncle look like a Frenchman, and that wearing them showed a lack of patriotism. Little by little, Foma began meddling in the management of the estate, and giving sage counsels on the subject. These sage counsels were terrible. The peasants soon saw the position and understood who was their real master, and scratched their heads uneasily. Later on, I overheard Foma talking to the peasants. I must confess I listened. Foma had told us before that he was fond of talking to intelligent Russian peasants, so one day he went to the threshing floor. After talking to the peasants about the farm work, though he could not tell oats from wheat, after sweetly dwelling on the sacred obligations of the peasant to his master, after touching lightly on electricity and the division of labour, subjects of which I need hardly say he knew nothing, after explaining to his listeners how the earth went round the sun, and being at last quite touched by his own eloquence, he began talking about the ministers. I understood. Pushkin used to tell a story of a father who impressed upon his little boy of four that he, his papa, was so brave that the Tsar loves papa. So, evidently, this papa needed this listener of 4 years old, and the peasants always listened to Foma Fomitch with cringing respect.
"And did you get a large salary from royalty, little father?"
a grey-headed old man called Arhip Korotki asked suddenly from the crowd of peasants, with the evident intention of being flattering. But the question struck Foma Fomitch as familiar, and he could not endure familiarity.
"And what business is that of yours, you lout?"
he answered, looking contemptuously at the poor peasant.
"Why are you thrusting forward your pug face? You want me to spit in it?"
Foma Fomitch always talked in that tone to the intelligent Russian peasant.
"You are our father," another peasant interposed. "You know we are ignorant people. You may be a major or a colonel or even your excellency. We don't know how we ought to speak to you."
"You lout!" repeated Foma Fomitch, mollified, however. "There are salaries and salaries, you blockhead. One will get nothing, though he is a general, because he does nothing to deserve it. He is of no service to the Tsar. But I got 20,000 when I was serving in the ministry, and I did not take it. I served for the honour of it. I had plenty of money of my own. I gave my salary to the cause of public enlightenment and to aid those whose homes have been burnt in Kazan."
"I say, so was it you who rebuilt Kazan, little father?"
the amazed peasant went on. The peasants wondered at Foma Fomitch as a rule.
"Oh, well, I had my share in it,"
Foma answered, with a show of reluctance, as though vexed with himself for deigning to converse on such a subject with such a person. His conversations with my uncle were of a different stamp.
"What were you in the past?"
Foma would say, for instance, lolling after an ample dinner in an easy chair, while a servant stood behind him brandishing a fresh lime branch to keep off the flies.
"What were you like before I came? But now I have dropped into your soul a spark of that heavenly fire which is glowing there now. Did I drop a spark of heavenly fire into your soul or not? Answer. Did I drop a spark or did I not?"
Foma Fomitch, indeed, could not himself have said why he asked such a question. But my uncle's silence and confusion at once spurred him on. He who had been so patient and downtrodden in the past now exploded like gunpowder at the slightest provocation. My uncle's silence seemed to him insulting, and he now insisted on an answer.
"Answer! Is the spark glowing in you or not?"
My uncle hesitated, shrank into himself, and did not know what line to take.
"Allow me to observe that I am waiting," said Foma, in an aggrieved voice.
"Mais répondez donc, Yegorushka,"
put in Madame la Générale, shrugging her shoulders.
"I am asking you, is that spark burning within you or not?"
Foma repeated condescendingly, taking a sweetmeat out of a bonbon box which always stood on a table before him by Madame la Générale's orders.
"I really don't know, Foma,"
my uncle answered at last, with despair in his eyes.
"Something of the sort, no doubt. You really had better not ask, or I am sure to say something wrong."
"Oh, very well. So you look upon me as so insignificant as not to deserve an answer, that's what you meant to say. But so be it. Let me be a nonentity."
"Oh, no, Foma, God bless you. Why, when did I imply that?"
"Yes, that's just what you did mean to say."
"I swear I didn't."
"Oh, very well, then. I lie. So then you charge me with trying to pick a quarrel on purpose. It's another insult added to all the past, but I will put up with this, too."
"Mais mon fils," cried Madame la Générale in alarm. "Foma Fomitch, Mama!" exclaimed my uncle in despair. "Upon my word, it's not my fault. Perhaps I may have let slip such a thing without knowing it. Oh, you mustn't mind me, Foma. I am stupid, you know. I feel I am stupid myself. I feel there is something amiss with me. I know, Foma, I know. You need not say anything,"
he went on, waving his hand.
"I have lived 40 years, and until now, until I knew you, I thought I was all right, like everyone else, and I didn't notice before that I was as sinful as a goat, an egoist of the worst description, and I've done such a lot of mischief that it is a wonder the world puts up with me."
"Yes, you certainly are an egoist,"
observed Foma with conviction.
"Well, I realize that I'm an egoist now. Yes, that's the end of it. I'll correct myself and be better."
"God grant you may,"
concluded Foma Fomitch, and, sighing piously, he got up from his armchair to go to his room for an after-dinner nap. Foma Fomitch always dozed after dinner. To conclude this chapter, may I be allowed to say something about my personal relations with my uncle, and to explain how I came to be face to face with Foma Fomitch, and, with no thought or suspicion, suddenly found myself in a vortex of the most important incidents that had ever happened in the blessed village of Stepanchikovo? With this, I intend to conclude my introduction and to proceed straight with my story. In my childhood, when I was left an orphan and alone in the world, my uncle took the place of a father to me, educated me at his expense, and did for me more than many a father does for his own child. From the first day he took me into his house, I grew warmly attached to him. I was 10 years old at the time, and I remember that we got on capitally and thoroughly understood each other. We spun tops together, and together stole her cap from a very disagreeable old lady who was a relation of both of us. I promptly tied the cap to the tail of a paper kite and sent it flying to the clouds. Many years afterwards, I saw something of my uncle for a short time in Petersburg, where I was finishing my studies, at his expense. During that time, I became attached to him with all the warmth of youth. Something generous, mild, truthful, light-hearted, and naive to the utmost degree struck me in his character and attracted everyone. When I left the university, I spent some time in Petersburg with nothing to do for the time, and, as is often the case with callow youths, was convinced that in a very short time I should do much that was very interesting and even great. I did not want to leave Petersburg. I wrote to my uncle at rather rare intervals, and only when I wanted money, which he never refused me. Meanwhile, I heard from a house serf of my uncle's, who came to Petersburg on some business or other, that marvellous things were taking place at Stepanchikovo. These first rumours interested and surprised me. I began writing to my uncle more regularly. He always answered me somewhat obscurely and strangely, and in every letter seemed trying to talk of nothing but learned subjects, expressing great expectations of me in the future in a literary and scientific line, and pride in my future achievements. At last, after a rather long silence, I received a surprising letter from him, utterly unlike all his previous letters. It was full of such strange hints, such rambling and contradictory statements, that at first I could make nothing of it. All that one could see was that the writer was in great perturbation. One thing was clear in the letter. My uncle gravely, earnestly, almost imploringly, urged me, as soon as possible, to marry his former ward, the daughter of a very poor provincial government clerk called Yezhevikin. This girl had received an excellent education at a school in Moscow at my uncle's expense, and was now the governess of his children. He wrote that she was unhappy, that I might make her happy, that I should, in fact, be doing a noble action. He appealed to the generosity of my heart, and promised to give her a dowry. Of the dowry, however, he spoke somewhat mysteriously, timidly, and he concluded the letter by beseeching me to keep all this a dead secret. This letter made such an impression on me that my head began to go round. And indeed, what raw young man would not have been affected by such a proposition, if only on its romantic side? Besides, I had heard that this young governess was extremely pretty. Yet I did not know what to decide, though I wrote to my uncle that I would set off for Stepanchikovo immediately. My uncle had sent me the money for the journey with the letter. Nevertheless, I lingered another 3 weeks in Petersburg, hesitating and somewhat uneasy. All at once, I happened to meet an old comrade of my uncle's, who had stayed at Stepanchikovo on his way back from the Caucasus to Petersburg. He was an elderly and judicious person, an inveterate bachelor. He told me with indignation about Foma Fomitch, and thereupon informed me of one circumstance of which I had no idea till then, namely, that Foma Fomitch and Madame la Générale had taken up a notion and were set upon the idea of marrying my uncle to a very strange lady, not in her first youth and scarcely more than half-witted, with an extraordinary history and almost 500,000 of dowry. That Madame la Générale had nearly succeeded in convincing this lady that they were relations, and so alluring her into the house. That my uncle, of course, was in despair, but would probably end by marrying the 500,000 of dowry. And that finally these two wiseacres, Madame la Générale and Foma Fomitch, were making a terrible onslaught on the poor defenceless governess, and were doing their utmost to turn her out of the house, apparently afraid that my uncle might fall in love with her, or perhaps knowing that he was already in love with her. These last words impressed me. However, to all my further questions as to whether my uncle really was or was not in love with her, my informant either could not or would not give me an exact answer, and indeed he told his whole story briefly, as it were reluctantly, and noticeably avoided detailed explanations. I thought it over. The news was so strangely contradictory of my uncle's letter and his proposition, but it was useless to delay. I decided to go to Stepanchikovo, hoping not only to comfort my uncle and bring him to reason, but even to save him. That is, if possible, to turn Foma out, to prevent the hateful marriage with the old maid, and finally, as I had come to the conclusion that my uncle's love was only a spiteful invention of Foma's, to rejoice the unhappy, but of course interesting young lady by the offer of my hand, and so on and so on. By degrees, I so worked myself up that, being young and having nothing to do, I passed from hesitation to the opposite extreme. I began burning with the desire to perform all sorts of great and wonderful deeds as quickly as possible. I even fancied that I was displaying extraordinary generosity by nobly sacrificing myself to secure the happiness of a charming and innocent creature. In fact, I remember that I was exceedingly well satisfied with myself during the whole of my journey. It was July. The sun was shining brightly, All around me stretched a vast expanse of fields full of unripe corn. I have so long sat bottled up in Petersburg that I felt as though I were only now looking at God's world.